unsure whether to be my father's son or his wife's husband. Mother was overwhelmed with holiday orders, so I passed my days on Buck's Peak just as I had as a child, in the kitchen, making homeopathics. I poured the distilled water and added the drops from the base formula, then passed the tiny glass bottle through the ring made by my thumb and index finger, counting to 50 or 100, then moving on to the next. Dad came in for a drink of water. He smiled when he saw me.
"Who knew we'd have to send you to Cambridge to get you in the kitchen where you belong?" he said.
In the afternoons, Sean and I saddled the horses and fought our way up the mountain, the horses half jumping to clamber through snowdrifts that reached their bellies. The mountain was beautiful and crisp, the air smelled of leather and pine. Sean talked about the horses, about their training, and about the colts he expected in the spring, and I remembered that he was always at his best when he was with his horses. I had been home about a week when the mountain was gripped by an intense cold spell. The temperature plunged, dropping to zero, then dropping further still. We put the horses away, knowing that if they worked up a sweat, it would turn to ice on their backs. The trough froze solid. We broke the ice, but it refroze quickly, so we carried buckets of water to each horse. That night, everyone stayed indoors. Mother was blending oils in the kitchen. Dad was in the extension, which I had begun to jokingly call the chapel. He was lying on the crimson sofa, a Bible resting on his stomach, while Cammy and Richard played hymns on the piano. I sat with my laptop on the love seat, near Dad, and listened to the music. I had just begun a message to Drew when something struck the back door. The door burst open, and Emily flew into the room. Her thin arms were wrapped around her body, and she was shaking, gasping for breath. She wore no coat, no shoes, nothing but jeans, an old pair I'd left behind, and one of my worn t-shirts. Mother helped her to the sofa, wrapping her in the nearest blanket. Emily bawled, and for several minutes, not even Mother could get her to say what had happened. Was everyone all right? Where was Peter? He was fragile, half the size he should have been, and he wore oxygen tubes because his lungs had never fully developed. Had his tiny lungs collapsed? His breathing stopped? The story came out haltingly, between erratic sobs and the clattering of teeth. From what I could tell, when Emily had gone to Stokes that afternoon to buy groceries, she had returned home with the wrong crackers for Peter. Sean had exploded. "How can he grow if you can't buy the right food?" he had screamed. Then he'd gathered her up and flung her from their trailer into a snowbank. She'd pounded on the door, begging to be let in. Then she'd run up the hillside to the house. I stared at her bare feet as she said this. They were so red, they looked as if they'd been burned. My parents sat with Emily on the sofa, one on each side of her, patting her shoulders and squeezing her hands. Richard paced a few feet behind them. He seemed frustrated, anxious, as if he wanted to explode into action and was only just being held in check. Cammy was still seated at the piano. She was staring at the group huddled on the couch, confused. She had not understood Emily. She did not understand why Richard was pacing, or why he paused every few seconds to glance at Dad, waiting for a word or gesture, any signal of what should be done. I looked at Cammy and felt a tightening in my chest. I resented her for witnessing this. I imagined myself in Emily's place, which was easy to do. I couldn't stop myself from doing it. And in a moment, I was in a parking lot, laughing my high-pitched cackle, trying to convince the world that my wrist wasn't breaking. Before I knew what I was doing, I had crossed the room. I grasped my brother's arm and pulled him with me to the piano. Emily was still sobbing, and I used her sobs to muffle my whispers. I told Cammy that what we were witnessing was private, and that Emily would be embarrassed by it tomorrow. For Emily's sake, I said, we should all go to our rooms and leave it in Dad's hands. Cammy stood. She had decided to trust me. Richard hesitated, giving Dad a long look. Then he followed her from the room. I walked with them down the hallway. Then I doubled back. I sat at the kitchen table and watched the clock. 5 minutes passed, then 10, Come on, Sean, I chanted under my breath. Come now. I'd convinced myself that if Sean appeared in the next few minutes, it would be to make sure Emily had made it to the house, that she hadn't slipped on the ice and broken a leg, wasn't freezing to death in a field. But he didn't come. 20 minutes later, when Emily finally stopped shaking, Dad picked up the phone.
Come get your wife, he shouted into it.
Mother was cradling Emily's head against her shoulder. Dad returned to the sofa and patted Emily's arm. As I stared at the three of them huddling together, I had the impression that all of this had happened before, and that everyone's part was well rehearsed, even mine. It would be many years before I would understand what had happened that night and what my role in it had been, how I had opened my mouth when I should have stayed silent, and shut it when I should have spoken out. What was needed was a revolution, a reversal of the ancient, brittle roles we'd been playing out since my childhood. What was needed, what Emily needed, was a woman emancipated from pretense, a woman who could show herself to be a man. Voice an opinion, take action in scorn of deference, a father. The French doors my father had installed squawked as they opened. Sean shuffled in wearing heavy boots and a thick winter coat. Peter emerged from the folds of thick wool where Sean had been shielding him from the cold and reached out for Emily. She clung to him. Dad stood. He motioned for Sean to take the seat next to Emily. I stood and went to my room, pausing to take a last look at my father, who was inhaling deeply, readying himself to deliver a lengthy lecture. It was very stern, Mother assured me 20 minutes later when she appeared at my door asking if I could lend Emily a pair of shoes and a coat. I fetched them and watched from the kitchen as she disappeared, tucked under my brother's arm. Chapter 31. Tragedy, then farce. The day before I returned to England, I drove 7 miles along the mountain range, then turned onto a narrow dirt road and stopped in front of a powder blue house. I parked behind an RV that was nearly as large as the house itself. I knocked. My sister answered. She stood in the doorway in flannel pajamas, a toddler on her hip, and 2 small girls clinging to her leg. Her son, about 6, stood behind her. Audrey stepped aside to let me pass, but her movements were stiff, and she avoided looking directly at me. We'd spent little time together since she'd married. I moved into the house, stopping abruptly in the entryway when I saw a 3-foot hole in the linoleum that plunged to the basement. I walked past the hole and into the kitchen, which was filled with the scent of our mother's oils, birch, eucalyptus, raven sarah. The conversation was slow, halting. Audrey asked me no questions about England or Cambridge. She had no frame of reference for my life, so we talked about hers, how the public school system was corrupt, so she was teaching her children herself at home. Like me, Audrey had never attended a public school. When she was 17, she had made a fleeting effort to get her GED. She had even enlisted the help of our cousin Missy, who had come up from Salt Lake City to tutor her. Missy had worked with Audrey for an entire summer, at the end of which she'd declared that Audrey's education hovered somewhere between the 4th and 5th grade levels, and that a GED was out of the question. I chewed my lip and stared at her daughter, who had brought me a drawing, wondering what education she could hope to receive from a mother who had none herself. We made breakfast for the children, then played with them in the snow. We baked, we watched crime dramas, and designed beaded bracelets. It was as if I had stepped through a mirror and was living a day in the life I might have had if I'd stayed on the mountain. But I hadn't stayed. My life had diverged from my sister's, and it felt as though there was no common ground between us. The hours passed. It was late afternoon, and still she felt distant from me. Still she refused to meet my gaze. I had brought a small porcelain tea set for her children, and when they began to quarrel over the teapot, I gathered up the pieces. The oldest girl reminded me that she was 5 now, which she said was too old to have a toy taken away. "If you act like a child," I said, "I'll treat you like one." I don't know why I said it. I suppose Sean was on my mind. I regretted the words even as they left my lips, hated myself for saying them. I turned to pass the tea set to my sister so she could administer justice however she saw fit, but when I saw her expression, I nearly dropped it. Her mouth hung open in a perfect circle. "Sean used to say that," she said, fixing her eyes on mine. That moment would stay with me. I would remember it the next day when I boarded a plane in Salt Lake City, and it would still be on my mind when I landed in London. It was the shock of it that I couldn't shake. Somehow, it had never occurred to me that my sister might have lived my life before I did. That term, I presented myself to the university like resin to a sculptor. I believed I could be remade, my mind recast. I forced myself to befriend other students, clumsily introducing myself again and again until I had a small circle of friends. Then I set out to obliterate the barriers that separated me from them. I tasted red wine for the first time, and my new friends laughed at my pinched face. I discarded my high-necked blouses and began to wear more fashionable cuts, fitted, often sleeveless, with less restrictive necklines. In photos from this period, I'm struck by the symmetry. I look like everyone else. In April, I began to do well. I wrote an essay on John Stuart Mill's concept of self-sovereignty, and my supervisor, Dr. David Runciman, said that if my dissertation was of the same quality, I might be accepted to Cambridge for a PhD. I was stunned. I, who had sneaked into this grand place as an imposter, might now enter through the front door. I set to work on my dissertation, again choosing Mill as the topic. One afternoon, near the end of term, when I was eating lunch in the library cafeteria, I recognized a group of students from my program. They were seated together at a small table. I asked if I could join them, and a tall Italian named Nick nodded. From the conversation, I gathered that Nick had invited the others to visit him in Rome during the spring holiday. "You can come too," he said. We handed in our final essays for the term, then boarded a plane. On our first evening in Rome, we climbed one of the 7 hills and looked out over the metropolis. Byzantine domes hovered over the city like rising balloons. It was nearly dusk. The streets were bathed in amber. It wasn't the color of a modern city, of steel, glass, and concrete. It was the color of sunset. It didn't look real. Nick asked me what I thought of his home, and that was all I could say. It didn't look real. At breakfast the next morning, the others talked about their families. Someone's father was a diplomat, another's was an Oxford don. I was asked about my parents. I said my father owned a junkyard. Nick took us to the conservatory where he'd studied violin. It was in the heart of Rome and was richly furnished, with a grand staircase and resonant halls. I tried to imagine what it would have been like to study in such a place, to walk across marble floors each morning and, day after day, come to associate learning with beauty. But my imagination failed me. I could only imagine the school as I was experiencing it now, as a kind of museum, a relic from someone else's life. For 2 days, we explored Rome, a city that is both a living organism and a fossil. Bleached structures from antiquity lay like dried bones, embedded in pulsating cables and thrumming traffic, the arteries of modern life. We visited the Pantheon, the Roman Forum, the Sistine Chapel. My instinct was to worship, to venerate. That was how I felt toward the whole city, that it should be behind glass, adored from a distance, never touched, never altered. My companions moved through the city differently, aware of its significance, but not subdued by it. They were not hushed by the Trevi Fountain. They were not silenced by the Colosseum. Instead, as we moved from one relic to the next, they debated philosophy. Hobbes and Descartes, Aquinas and Machiavelli. There was a kind of symbiosis in their relationship to these grand places. They gave life to the ancient architecture by making it the backdrop of their discourse, by refusing to worship at its altar as if it were a dead thing. On the third night, there was a rainstorm. I stood on Nick's balcony and watched streaks of lightning race across the sky, claps of thunder chasing them. It was like being on Buck's Peak to feel such power in the earth and sky. The next morning was cloudless. We took a picnic of wine and pastries to the grounds of the Villa Borghese. The sun was hot, the pastries ambrosial. I could not remember ever feeling more present. Someone said something about Hobbes, and without thinking, I recited a line from Mill. It seemed the natural thing, to bring this voice from the past into a moment so saturated with the past already, even if the voice was mixed with my own. There was a pause while everyone checked to see who had spoken. Then someone asked which text the line was from, and the conversation moved forward. For the rest of the week, I experienced Rome as they did, as a place of history, but also as a place of life, of food and traffic and conflict and thunder. The city was no longer a museum. It was as vivid to me as Buck's Peak, the Piazza del Popolo, the baths of Caracalla, Castel Sant'Angelo. These became as real to my mind as the princess, the red railway car, the sheer. The world they represented of philosophy, science, literature, an entire civilization took on a life that was distinct from the life I had known. At the Galleria Nazionale d'Arte Antica, I stood before Caravaggio's Judith beheading Holofernes and did not once think about chickens. I don't know what caused the transformation, why suddenly I could engage with the great thinkers of the past rather than revere them to the point of muteness, but there was something about that city, with its white marble and black asphalt, crusted with history, ablaze in traffic lights, that showed me I could admire the past without being silenced by it. I was still breathing in the fustiness of ancient stone when I arrived in Cambridge. I rushed up the staircase, anxious to check my email, knowing there would be a message from Drew. When I opened my laptop, I saw that Drew had written, but so had someone else, my sister. I opened Audrey's message. It was written in one long paragraph, with little punctuation and many spelling errors, and at first I fixated on these grammatical irregularities as a way to mute the text. But the words would not be hushed. They shouted at me from the screen. The language from the referenced email is paraphrased, not directly quoted. The meaning has been preserved. Audrey said she should have stopped Sean many years ago, before he could do to me what he'd done to her. She said that when she was young, she'd wanted to tell Mother, to ask for help, but she'd thought Mother wouldn't believe her. She'd been right. Before her wedding, she'd experienced nightmares and flashbacks, and she'd told Mother about them. Mother had said the memories were false, impossible. "I should have helped you," Audrey wrote, "but when my own mother didn't believe me, I stopped believing myself." It was a mistake she was going to correct. "I believe God will hold me accountable if I don't stop Sean from hurting anyone else," she wrote. She was going to confront him and our parents, and she was asking me to stand with her. "I am doing this with or without you, but without you, I will probably lose." I sat in the dark for a long time. I resented her for writing me. I felt she had torn me from one world, one life, where I was happy, and dragged me back into another. I typed a response. I told her she was right, that of course we should stop Sean, but I asked her to do nothing until I could return to Idaho. I don't know why I asked her to wait, what benefit I thought time would yield. I don't know what I thought would happen when we talked to our parents, but I understood instinctively what was at stake. As long as we had never asked, it was possible to believe that they would help. To tell them was to risk the unthinkable, It was to risk learning,